We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you back, Mr. Parrish.
Oh, wow. Well, I wasn't aware I'd gone anywhere.
Oh, you were gone last week.
That's part of the problem.
See, I didn't go anywhere. Like here.
All right. Lots to cover.
I'm definitely feeling better, so that helps.
Excellent.
Good.
Lots to cover, starting with local and hearing this week on the John T. Williams shooting.
Yeah, the inquest started this week in the John T. Williams shooting. Officer Ian Burke and several witnesses who witnessed the shooting gave their testimony in court this week. And what I thought was interesting was Officer Burke gave us a peek inside of his mind and inside his SPD training. He described Williams as showing, quote, pre-attack indicators. And then he described what those indicators were: a clenched jaw, a furrowed brow,
non-white skin,
thousand eye stare. Yeah. This is after having described Williams as being impaired. In other words, he thought Williams was drunk. And blood alcohol tests did show that Williams had more alcohol in his blood than was that he was over the legal limit for intoxication. So he was impaired. And you could look at this list of pre-attack indicators given by Burke and say, well, you know, I know a lot of people who, when they're impaired, tend to show those pre-attack indicators when they're just trying to walk a straight line, you know, much less deal with somebody who is yelling at them incoherently or who they can't hear.
Yeah, especially when it's unexpected.
Yeah. And then Burke showed, and you can see the video on the, if you go to the Seattle Times website, and then Burke gave testimony demonstrating the, what he said was, Williams' stance at the time he shot him. And when I saw it, my thought was, oh, you idiot. I mean, because the way he demonstrated what Williams did, it did not look to me like Williams was any threat at all.
Bear in mind that initially the SPD claimed that Williams was lunging at the officer.
Yes, brandishing the knife is what Burke said. And yet when he demonstrated Williams' posture, he didn't brandish the pen in his hand. In spite of what news commentators may have said in articles in the Seattle Times and elsewhere, from what I could see, it did not look like a threatening position. It looked like the way people turn around to when they're surprised. That's what it looked like to me.
But he still had the piece of wood with him. He was still working on it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then of course, after Burke's testimony, I think the Seattle Times headline was "Two Witnesses Contradict Officer's Testimony." Actually, from reading the Seattle Times reports, it was more like five or more witnesses who contradicted Burke's testimony, saying that they didn't think Williams was any threat at all. Several of those people were close enough to see exactly what happened. And so the inquest is going on. The jury isn't going to rule on the guilt of the guilt or the innocence of Officer Burke. The jury's going to answer a selection of questions put to them, and then the King County prosecutor will take those answers and determine whether or not to file any charges against Officer Burke.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Moving on, a couple of U.S. attorneys weighing in on looking for an investigation here locally.
Yeah. Former U.S. attorneys John and Mike McKay, who are brothers and served at different times as U.S. attorneys over the past 20 years, added their names to they sent a letter to current U.S. attorney Jenny Durkin, asking Durkin to launch a federal civil rights probe of the Seattle Police Department. Now, there are a couple things that are significant.
This comes after the December letter by the ACLU and several community groups asking for exactly the same thing.
Yeah, there are a couple things that are significant about this. One is that as opposed to the ACLU, which, you know, we love them, they do wonderful work, but, you know, they are the usual suspects when it comes to civil rights and human rights issues. These are a couple of Republican-appointed former U.S. attorneys who routinely in their work with police departments, saying that not only are the officers involved in these specific incidents at fault, but there is system-wide cover-ups going on. and system-wide cover-ups that start at the top with, in the case that they cited from 2009, then acting SPD chief John Diaz, who has since been promoted to becoming the permanent chief. So these are calls that come not so much from, you know, the gadflies who are always complaining about the SPD. Oh, they're shooting people again. But it's something that comes from the legal mainstream that is saying that there is a systematic department-wide problem with not only the way that these incidents are keep cropping up, but also the way that SPD has been resistant to releasing any information in terms of how the incidents play out, and has been resistant to investigating itself with anything remotely resembling the due diligence that's necessary for incidents of these gravity.
Right. And in addition to talking about the SPD and Chief Diaz, the McKays also discussed the Office of Professional Accountability. Now, they were both heavily involved in helping former Mayor Rice set up the OPA.
As was Ginny Durkin, the current U.S. attorney.
Yeah. And so it's very telling that these two attorneys are coming out and saying the OPA played a key role in covering up some very critical evidence in a case that they worked on, and that's also at issue here, not just how the SPD functions, but the fact that the OPA has been corrupted by the SPD and is also colluding with them to cover up evidence.
All right. Moving on. State legislature started their session this week, and there's been some different legislators putting forward proposals.
Yeah, and one that I particularly wanted to highlight this week was State Representative Lori Sequist, a Democrat from Gig Harbor. Now, this is the same guy who has been one of the Democrats insisting that if there are cost overruns for the tunnel, that Seattle residents should pay for it. But he's also announced that he's introducing legislation that would close $2 billion in corporate tax loopholes. The $2 billion figure comes from state calculations as to what was needed to more or less bring the state's education system into compliance with its constitutional obligation to pay for basic public education. You remember that in the Washington State Constitution, funding K-12 education is one of the state's primary responsibilities. And we're not doing it. We're not even close to doing it. Total estimates of the cost of the loopholes in corporate credits and you know, tax loopholes and whatnot in the state budget range anywhere from $90 million to $65 billion. And so Sequist's point is that $2 billion is not only a pretty reasonable estimate of something that could easily be afforded, but if it's a choice between closing $2 billion in those loopholes and decimating the state's total education system, then that's well worth the trade-off and certainly would outweigh any kind of economic impact of closing the loopholes. What's been really interesting to this is the complete lack of support that Sequist has been getting so far from other Democrats. You would expect opposition from Republicans on this, even though they claim to be the party of fiscal responsibility. But Democrats as well, they've all got their little pet campaign contributors that they know which side their bread is buttered on. And unfortunately, we're seeing how Olympia works in pretty stark relief with this particular incident.
All right. Moving on to national, and shortly after the show last week, there were tragic shootings in Tucson.
Yeah, in Tucson, Arizona, where Jared Loughner, a young paranoid schizophrenic man, shot Gabrielle Giffords and about a dozen other people at a Safeway, where they were holding a Congress on Your Corner meeting of Gabrielle Giffords, who had just been recently elected to Congress in Arizona.
Re-elected
to Congress. And, and I can say about this what you've been hearing probably all morning and hearing all week from various media outlets that it's Tea Party rhetoric and it's anti-government rhetoric that's at fault and everything. But what I want to point out a couple things here that, yeah, sure, extreme right-wing rhetoric and anti-government rhetoric may have directed his anger, but you're talking about someone who was mentally ill And what I find interesting is a lot of the groups that are kind of battening down and saying, well, you can't have gun control right now because we all need our guns to help protect us against people like this. All of that stuff about how Americans love their weapons, et cetera, kind of relies on this underlying assumption that an armed populace can protect itself from a repressive government, which is ridiculous in this day and age when you're talking about a government that can deploy unmanned aerial drones that fly at 65,000 feet and can drop bunker buster bombs on anyone anywhere in the world, not to mention the surveillance power of the U.S. government. But once you look at that, you think, well, it's idiotic to think that having your semi-automatic pistol is going to protect you from something like that, when in fact what it's actually doing is it's flooding this country with weapons that anybody can get at any time, regardless of their mental health status. In addition, really, you don't have to fear that much from the government when you have guys in business suits coming to your neighborhood and selling you predatory mortgages. You know, if you really want to talk about who are we in slavery to, I wouldn't say it was the U.S. government. In addition, I want to point out too
I think those folks run the U.S. government too. So
yeah,
in
exactly.
A lot of ways.
Yeah, exactly. And in addition, I want to point out that a lot of the people who are very against gun control are also very much against the new healthcare law, saying that this is government intrusion. It's forcing me to buy insurance. Blah blah blah. When I just want to say, I think if Jared Loughner had access to a functioning healthcare system, Jared Loughner or his family had access to a functioning healthcare system, he might have been treated for his paranoid schizophrenia, and he may never have killed six people last Saturday. Last Saturday, I thought it was Sunday.
But, no, it was Saturday morning, right after the show, as Mike said. Yeah, there were several things that jumped out about this to me, and of course the incident itself was incredibly tragic, but the response to it has been kind of fascinating, in that, you know, you've had all of this debate over whether political rhetoric in this country has gone too far, and as they mentioned in Counterspin, there's been this kind of false equivalence where, you know, the people in Democrats do it, the Republicans do it. Well, no, there's really only one side that's been talking about killing people. And, you know, when you're talking about somebody who's mentally ill, you're talking about somebody who's a paranoid schizophrenic, the classic symptoms, and obviously, you know, Loughner hasn't been diagnosed, and we don't know for sure what his condition is, but certainly some of the things that he's posted on places like YouTube and MySpace and so forth suggest paranoid schizophrenia. And one of the classic symptoms of that is a magnification of your environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're picking up on stimulus that you pick up from your environment around you. That's the point that's being made with a lot of these concerns. And it's been really very, very interesting to see their response, the very defensive response, and the response claiming victimization, you know, as though it wasn't given to the victim here. It's been people like Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and some of the others who've been accused, rightfully so, of you know, fomenting hateful rhetoric.
Well, and it's not as if people hadn't warned them ahead of time or pointed out.
Giffords herself warned Palin ahead of time.
Exactly. This very possibility. Now, not all people with paranoid schizophrenia are violent, but a lot of people who are violent and go on rampage shootings are paranoid schizophrenics. And so it's not as if we couldn't foresee something like this happening.
Yeah, and so you wind up with spectacles like, you know, Sarah Palin, you know, invoking the idea of blood libel, which, you know, I wasn't really aware that she was Jewish, but, and it was also very interesting to see that, you know, she got pounced on all over by legacy media for invoking a term that is usually, used in terms of bigotry against Jews, whereas bigotry against blacks and Latino immigrants by Tea Party spokespeople pretty much goes unremarked in mainstream mm-hmm. media. So that was an interesting double standard. And then you had John Boehner skipping the memorial service in order to go to a Republican fundraiser, even after one of the members of the House of Representatives is shot. You would think that the Speaker of the House, just out of the nature of his position, would prioritize you know, rallying behind one of his members, even though they're from the opposite party. But no, in John Boehner's world, courting lobbyists is more important.
Yeah. Or at the very,
was interesting too.
Or at the very least, he might have attended the memorial to make it something other than a Democratic Party rally, which I think fairly a lot of media people pointed out it had the characteristics of it, almost of a Democratic Party rally.
Yeah, when was the last time you heard people cheering at a memorial service?
Yeah, that, I found that kind of creepy. But.
All right. Anything else on that subject?
No, let's move on.
All right. The EPA.
Yeah, Spruce Number One Mine in Logan County, West Virginia is the largest proposed mountaintop removal mine in West Virginia history. And this week, the Environmental Protection Agency vetoed it. They refused to they refused to allow it because of the enormous amount of environmental degradation that it would entail. That's notable enough, but what's even more notable is that the state's two Democratic senators calling it an outrage have been allying themselves with the various Republicans and probably have the vote in Congress, in both the new Republican-controlled House and the Senate, to support a bill that would strip the EPA of regulatory authority over mountaintop removal. So in the short term, it's very, very good news for the environment in the Appalachian Mountains. But in the long term, thanks to Congress, it may lead to a significant weakening of the ability to stop big coal from literally destroying entire ecosystems.
All right. Moving on. Twitter this week.
Yeah, this week we learned about a secret U.S. subpoena of the Twitter accounts of five of the main volunteers for the WikiLeaks organization, including Julian Assange and one of the folks whose records were subpoenaed is a member of parliament for Iceland. So it's interesting, of these five people, only two are U.S. citizens. The rest are foreign nationals. But of course, U.S. prosecutors in subpoenaing the information weren't really looking for the messages that these folks had sent on their Twitter accounts. What they wanted were things like addresses, telephone numbers, credit card numbers, bank account numbers and bank account information, the very kinds of things that are often requested in drug cases and in terrorism cases. So it really shows you what secret U.S. courts, secret subpoenas, and what all of the money we're pouring into Homeland Security and into anti-terrorism initiatives is really going for now. It's being used now to clamp down on the media. On free speech.
Yeah, and let's hope that WikiLeaks releases some information on how the Department of Homeland Security and some of these secret tribunals are actually working.
Right. I think, and two, what's unusual about this case, too, is that we're actually hearing about this subpoena, and that's only because the lawyers for Twitter sued in court in order to have the subpoena unsealed so that Twitter could actually talk about it and could actually inform the people who were the subject of the investigation that this was happening. In most such cases, the people who are the subject of the investigation never find out that their information has been subpoenaed, and it's never made public because companies would be subject to prosecution if they did make it public. They're threatened by federal prosecutors not to make this information public.
In fact, under the Patriot Act for terrorism cases, it's illegal to divulge publicly information on this, even if you're the affected person.
Yes, and in this case, three of the affected people are not U.S. citizens, and Birgitta John's daughter, who's a member of parliament for Iceland, she's threatened to make this a diplomatic issue. And in fact, the Icelandic government is now requesting information from the U.S. government about why they subpoenaed her personal information.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to international, starting with Tunisia.
Yeah, in Tunisia, there's been some coverage this week of ongoing riots in Tunisia that have been going on for more than a month. I find that kind of interesting that now the Western media is picking up on it now that there's been an overthrow of the Tunisian government, our longtime ally in the war on terror. The Tunisian government has been extremely repressive. The president's been in power for some 23 years. He took over in a bloodless coup in 1987, and there have been no democratic elections since, even though he promised when he took over power that he would not be president for life. Clearly, the only reason he's not going to be president for life is because protesters threw him out. Now, in the ongoing protests that that have been, you know, happening for more than a month now, the police and security forces have killed dozens of people, and yet the coverage here has been minimal until just kind of the last moment when it looked like the government would be overthrown. And the coverage has been...
When our U.S. allied government will be overthrown.
Yes. And the coverage has been pretty bad. It's been, you know, oh, Tunisia has this repressive government. Oh, they're, you know... They're corrupt.
Yeah,
they're corrupt.
All these Arabs are like this.
Yeah. And
that's kind of the subject.
And it's almost as if the media is going, oh, look, you know, it's going to be a new dawn for you know, the Arab world. They may throw off their shackles, et cetera, et cetera.
Is that D-A-W-N or D-O-N?
Yeah. And the Bush administration was right. You know, a little bit of war on terror and you're going to see the dominoes fall in the Middle East, and we'll have brought democracy to the Middle East, blah, blah, blah. And I want to point out that there's a very, very strong economic aspect to what's going on in Tunisia. What sparked the riots in the first place was a suicide by a college-educated man who could not find work in his field or in any field in Tunisia, and so he set up a vending cart in a local market to sell food. And because he didn't have the proper license, the police came and took all of his produce. And in despair, he killed himself. And it has led to riots in a country where unemployment is extremely high and food prices are rising. And I just want to point out that demonstrations and riots are going on in a lot of other countries around the world for these very same economic reasons. In Morocco, in Algeria, in Egypt, in Jordan, in places in Latin America and in Asia and in Africa, there's been a lot of suffering because of the economic downturn and because of rises in commodity prices, a lot of which are caused by investors speculating on the commodities markets.
Yeah, it's very telling that in Tunisia and a lot of parts of the world, when people are not only suffering from high chronic unemployment, but seeing that some sectors of society are prospering based on that economic system, they riot.
Unlike here.
We don't do that here. I wonder why.
Yeah, well, in Tunisia, the unemployment rate is at 14%. Well, here in the U.S., the official unemployment rate's about 9%, but the unofficial employment rate, the one that counts all of the people who are no longer getting benefits and who have pretty much dropped off the radar of the government.
Or who were self-employed to begin with and weren't eligible for benefits.
Is about twice that. And it could be as high as 20%, but they're not in the official statistics yet. We don't have riots here. That's kind of interesting to me.
All right. Moving on, Australia.
Yeah, while Tucson got all the headlines this week, there was actually a bigger story going on in the larger context of things. That was the record monsoon rains and floods that struck the northeastern Australian state of Queensland and the third largest city in Australia, Brisbane. The floods have literally wiped out much of the city and also a number of smaller outlying cities in the state. The result of record rains during the monsoon season in what is basically a subtropical and tropical environment there. And those rains are expected to continue for the next several months. So they're going to get worse, not better. Now, the reason this is particularly notable as opposed to just another weather-related event is that there is a clearer correlation with this than almost any other major catastrophic climate event in recent history where climate change is clearly directly responsible for this. The waters in the Coral Sea, which is the part of the South Pacific that trade winds come off of and go into Queensland and northeast Australia, never before been recorded as being so warm. And, of course, the warm waters are feeding the moisture in the air that leads to those torrential rains.
Storms,
so
yes.
climate scientists are saying, yes, this is a direct result of climate change, and we're going to see more events like this in the future. Yet the media coverage, such as it's been in this country, has been very, very reluctant to tie this to climate change or global warming.
All right. Afghanistan.
Yeah, Marine General Arnold Fields, who is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. We've talked about him in the past on this program. Over the past several years, his office has issued a number of very critical reports of the quote-unquote reconstruction effort in Afghanistan. He was forced to resign this week after once again criticizing the waste and scams involved in the enormous amounts of money that are going into, you know, building schools and hospitals and whatnot in Afghanistan. After 9 years of this, there's very little to show for it, but there, one of the main things to show for it is profiteering contractors, especially KBR, the former subsidiary of Halliburton, now on its own, which was included in the majority of the cases cited by Fields' office. Because of that, a number of Congress people and a number of people in the executive branch, in the Obama administration, as well as, of course, among the defense contractors involved, have been pushing for his removal, and they've succeeded. We've now found out pretty clearly what the war in Afghanistan is about, and it has really nothing to do with Afghans, terror, or anything else like that. It has to do with this profiteering.
All right. Mm-hmm. And I just want to include that we got an email from Tom Mallard saying that paranoid schizophrenics, he was challenging one of the stats someone must have said that they commit suicide, or 40% try suicide. He says 10% kill themselves, so... 40% try, 10% kill themselves.
I don't think we talked about suicide. We talked about propensity for violence.
Yeah, we didn't talk about suicide
that's
at all.
Said, not
but,
all.
But it's still useful
to share.
But it's still a useful statistic, yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. I think I said not all paranoid schizophrenics are violent. In fact, I don't think that the majority of them are. But there is a core minority of them that, if they exhibit violent tendencies, can be extremely violent and extremely dangerous.
And let me be fair. Let me read exactly what he wrote, because I think he was adding to it. Paranoid schizos also commit suicide. 40% try, 10% kill themselves. So, end of message. So, there you have it. Okay. Events.
Yeah, Martin Luther King weekend coming up this weekend, of course, and a couple of annual events that celebrate that out at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Kitsap County, opposite the nuclear weapons submarine base at Bangor. There are events going on all this weekend, starting this morning. For a full calendar of those events, you can go to www.gzcenter.org. And then the annual MLK celebration in Seattle will start at 9:30 at Garfield High School with workshops, an 11 o'clock rally, and then at noon there will be a commemorative march down to the Federal Building here in Seattle. And so far the weather forecast is looking like the rain will hold off for that. So let's hope we have a good year for it this time.
Come rain or shine.
Absolutely.
Every year.
Certainly there have been years past where it has absolutely poured during that march, but I don't think that's going to happen this year.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You find it at your friendly neighborhood website, www.eatthestate.org, with news and columns and commentary and blog stuff and all that kind of good thing. And there's also the ability to contribute to Eat the State. If you're interested in doing that, drop us a line at editorial@eatthestate.org.